readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm offering what I think so many of us could use in this post-holiday world. Escape, escape, escape! The holiday season is over. It's a long, cold slog through winter, and it's so very dispiriting having to face all those Christmas bills. But courage and a great thriller can go a long way to lighten your spirit. I've got a fantastic list to help beat the doldrums. So, with diversion as our goal today, let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Back in August 13, we previewed The Snowman by Joe Nesbo, called by some the next Stieg Larsson. Now, in The Leopard, two young women are found murdered in Oslo. Media coverage quickly reaches a fever pitch. Could this be the work of a serial killer? The crime scene offers no coherent clues. The police investigation is stalled, and the one man who might be able to help doesn't want to be found. Traumatized by his last case, Inspector Harry Hole has lost himself in the squalor of Hong Kong's opium dens. Yet, when he is compelled to return to Norway, Harry's instincts begin to take over. After a female MP is discovered brutally murdered, nothing can keep him from the investigation. There is little to go on: a piece of rope, a scrap of wool, a bit of gravel, an unexpected connection between the victims. And Harry will soon come to understand he is dealing with a psychopath for whom insanity is a vital retreat, someone who will put him to the test in both his professional and personal lives as never before. Robin Sachs narrates.
The ceiling and the room were illuminated by a standard lamp leaning against the wall in one of the corners, bare gray concrete. Apart from the lamp, the room contained a white plastic picnic table, two chairs, two empty beer bottles, and two people. Him and her. She smelled a leather glove as a finger tugged lightly at the red loop hanging from her mouth, and the next moment her head seemed to explode. The ball had expanded and forced itself against the inside of her mouth, but however wide she opened her jaws, the pressure was constant. He had examined her with a concentrated, engaged expression, like an orthodontist checking to see whether the braces were fitting as they should. A little smile intimated satisfaction. With her tongue, she could feel circular ridges around the holes in the ball, and that was what was pressing against her palate, against the soft flesh of her tongue, against her teeth, against the uvula. She had tried to say something. He had listened patiently to the inarticulate sounds emerging from her mouth, had nodded when she gave up and had taken out a syringe. The drop on the tip had glinted in the flashlight's beam. He had whispered something in her ear. "Don't touch the wire." Then he had injected her in the neck. She was out in seconds. She listened to her own terrified breathing as she blinked in the darkness. She had to do something. She placed her palms on the chair seat, which was clammy from her perspiration, and pushed herself up. No one stopped her. She advanced with tiny steps until she hit a wall, groped her way along to a smooth, cold surface, the metal door. She pulled at the bolt. It didn't budge. Locked. Of course it was locked. What had she been thinking? Was that laughter she could hear, or was the sound coming from inside her head? Where was he? Why was he playing with her like this? Do something. Think. But to think she would first have to get rid of this metal ball before the pain drove her insane. She put her thumb and first finger in the corners of her mouth, felt the ridges, tried in vain to get her fingers under one of them, had a coughing fit and a panic attack when she couldn't breathe. She realized that the ridges had made the flesh around her windpipe swell, that soon she would be in danger of suffocating. She kicked the metal door, tried to scream, but the ball stifled the sound. She gave up again, leaned against the wall, listened. Was that his wary tread she could hear? Was he moving around the room? Was he playing blind man's buff with her? Or was it her blood throbbing past her ears? She steeled herself against the pain and forced her mouth shut. The ridges were hardly down before they sprang back and forced her mouth open again. The ball seemed to be pulsating now, as though it had become an iron heart, a part of her. Do something. Think. Springs. The ridges were spring-loaded. They had jumped up when he pulled the wire. Don't touch the wire, he had said. Why not? What would happen? She slid down the wall until she was sitting. Cold damp rose from the concrete floor. She wanted to scream again, but she couldn't. Quiet. Silence. All the things she should have said to those she loved, instead of the words that had served to fill the silence with those to whom she was indifferent. There was no way out. There was just her and this unbelievable pain, her head exploding. Don't touch the wire. If she pulled it, the ridges might retract into the ball and she would be spared the pain. Her thoughts ran in the same circles. How long had she been here? 2 hours? 8 hours? 20 minutes? If all she had to do was pull the wire, why hadn't she done it? Because the warning had been given by an obvious sicko. Or was this part of the game? Being tricked into resisting the temptation to stop this quite unnecessary pain? Or was the game about defying the warning and pulling the wire, causing something dreadful to happen?
That was The Leopard by Joe Nesbo. Readers, I am thrilled to have Patricia Cornwell as my guest today. As I am sure you know, Patricia is the creator of Dr. Kay Scarpetta, Virginia's chief medical examiner, and the character who changed the face of contemporary crime fiction. Patricia is originally from Miami, but spent formative years in North Carolina. She graduated from Davidson College. In 1979, Cornwell started working as a reporter for the Charlotte Observer and soon began covering crime. In 1984, Patricia took a job at the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of Virginia. She worked there for 6 years, first as a technical writer and then as a computer analyst. She also volunteered to work with the Richmond Police Department. In her early writing days, Cornwell wrote 3 novels that were rejected before publication. But in 1990, she broke through with the first installment of her Scarpetta series, Postmortem. The novel won the Edgar, Creasy, Anthony, and McCavity Awards and the French Prix de Roman d'Aventure in a single year, a feat still unequaled by any other author. In 1999, Dr. Scarpetta, the character, won the Sherlock Award for the best detective created by an American author. Red Mist is your 19th Scarpetta novel. I've often wondered how difficult it is to introduce main characters to folks reading you for the first time, while returning readers feel they're picking up right where they left off.
That's a great question, and that is actually the biggest thing that I have to deal with every time I start a Scarpetta novel. And when I began Red Mist, it was the same thing. I have to find a way to make sure I write the book as if the people who are reading it have never read the ones that preceded it. And it's important for people to know that they don't have to read my books in sequence. And in fact, you can pick up Red Mist and not have read the first 18 books, and you're just fine, because I tell you who Scarpetta is and who the characters are, and I give enough background so that you understand what's gone on before that has placed Scarpetta where she is right this minute. And that is the that's a really big challenge with every book, because you don't want to bore people with backstory, but you also don't want to leave somebody out if they've never read any of the books. So that's the that is something that I work very hard to do.
Well, you do it seamlessly, I have to say. In writing this book and all your books, do you spend a certain amount of time assimilating new developments in forensic techniques before putting pen to paper?
Yes, I always begin a book by doing research. When I finished Port Mortuary, for example, and turned it in, that was the last book, I immediately started mapping out the research that I was going to do for the new one. And the first thing that I knew is that I was going to have to go visit a women's prison, because I knew that Scarpetta was going to go down to Georgia and talk to an inmate in prison, and that was going to lead to a big, her getting into a very treacherous situation. So I went to this really, actually an excellent women's prison in Tennessee, and spent a long day there getting a tour and exploring every aspect of life in a penitentiary. I talked to a lot of the inmates, and everything from general population to death row. And then basically I used that as a model to create what really is a fictitious prison in Georgia. And I'm sure when people read the book, they'll be glad that the Georgia prison for women doesn't really exist, because it's a horrible place and some really bad things are going on there. Mm. So I start doing research, and then when I feel that I have enough to get started, then I start creating the story.
Hmm. In researching this interview, I was fascinated to learn of the existence of the Body Farm. Can you let our listeners know a little about that?
Yes, the Body Farm is a 2-acre research facility in Knoxville, Tennessee, where people can donate their bodies to forensic and scientific research. And it's been there for over 20 years. And it's 2 acres surrounded by a very high fence, very close to the riverbank. And it sounds like it's surreal, but there's a waiting list. I mean, a lot of people are very eager to do this, and the bodies are put in all sorts of different situations, so that forensic anthropologists and other types of scientists can learn more about decomposition. And the reason that's important is it can tell us things such as time of death, and it also can tell us if something that a forensic pathologist finds with a body might have to do with why that person died, or is it in fact some artifact that occurs very naturally because of the setting the body is in after death, you know, whether it's the woods or the trunk of a car, buried or exposed, clothed or unclothed. There's any variety of things that are done at this facility.
Hmm. The relationships that you write among Scarpetta, Benton, Lucy, and Marino are so complex, and your forensic science is so fascinating. How challenging is it for you to balance the two in the body of the book?
Well, again, everything about writing one of these novels is a challenge. I consider it a little bit like conducting a symphony orchestra. There's so much going on. You have forensic science, forensic medicine, you have the criminal investigation, you have setting, you have these characters, both the ones that people know and new ones that you introduce. And all of it has to work in a certain harmony. You don't want one thing to be louder than another. You don't want things to be out of balance. You don't want so much about the characters' relationships that it overwhelms the plot. And you don't want something that's so much just plot-driven that the characters become two-dimensional. So it's really an art form that I have to be very meticulous with, so that it's really so that people really enjoy the ride.
Yeah, I saw your quote referring to the feasibility of writing while on book tour. Quote, my characters would say, we're not going to talk to you right now. If you can't give us your full attention, then come and see us later. So do you channel your characters when you're writing?
Well, it sort of is. I kind of do, because I immerse myself so much in the research and absorbing what I need to really create that world for my readers. And basically, I have to, in many ways, look through Scarpetta's eyes. I'm sort of walking in her shoes, and I just give myself up to that process to make it very real. And it really is true. If I'm very distracted and tired or being very extroverted like I'm being right now, there's no point in my even opening up the story that I'm working on, because nothing's going to happen. Hmm. It really does require my undivided attention. And in fact, when I really get back into the 20th Scarpetta novel, when I go home, at some point, you know, I will really isolate myself. Sometimes I even go away from home and just so that I'm doing nothing but work, but focusing on the work.
Well, I have to confess, I love Pete Marino. I'd love to have some burgers and beer with him. Is he based on someone real, and how has he evolved throughout your novels?
Actually, Marino's not based on it. None of the characters are based on anybody real or anybody I've ever met. And in fact, they're so unique to me that I've never even met anybody that particularly reminds me of these characters. But Marino has evolved quite a lot since the very first book, which came out in 1990. He's gone from being really sort of a bigoted, kind of crass homicide detective, to then he became a real jerk for a while, to be honest with you. And now I think he's evolved where he's much more of an enlightened person who's funny, but he's really shrewd. He's very devoted to Scarpetta. It's just like I can't imagine the two of them not working together. They really, in fact, this whole team of characters, Lucy, her niece, who's the computer expert, Benton, her husband, who's the FBI criminal investigative analyst, basically a profiler, and then Marino, who's her chief death investigator, they're like an extended family, and they really belong together.
Yeah. How did your interest in helicopters begin?
Well, I was, you know, back in the early 90s, I was using them to get places very quickly and land in places where planes couldn't go. And I just thought, you know, I bet you Lucy would be a helicopter pilot. This is Scarpetta's niece. So I started taking lessons, and of course I fell in love with it. And I've had my pilot's license for about 12 years now, and I have my own helicopter. It's really fun to give the readers a chance to know what it feels like to fly a helicopter. And in order to do that, it's really important that I know what it feels like. It's the same with motorcycles and fast cars, or in one of my books, Scarpetta has to scuba dive, so I learned how to do that. I try to experience things within reason so I can make it very, very real for my readers.
Mm-hmm. Fox Studios has acquired the film rights to the Scarpetta novels, and Angelina Jolie is set to play the character. Have you met her, and would you like to write the screenplay?
I have met Angelina Jolie, and she is attached to the Scarpetta movie. I mean, no one has actually been cast yet. It's still the early stages. And there's a wonderful screenwriter named Cary O'Salem who actually has written the script, and I've become very good friends with him, and I help him in any way that he needs, but I'm not a screenwriter. I wish I were. In the old days, I actually tried to write screenplays when we've been through so many movie options for this character, but it's just not my gift. And I have enough respect for other types of artists to know that you have to let them do what they know how to do, and I can't do everything. So we're hoping that we're going to start filming next year, 2012, and I'm also very hopeful that maybe fairly soon we're going to start hearing more details about when things are going to start happening with this movie.
Mm. So is your next book going to be another Scarpetta book or something else?
I am already well into my 20th Scarpetta novel. As soon as I get home from book tour and get rested, I'm going to get back to work on that. And I'm feeling excited about it. I think it's going to be a really fun book.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us today. And I'm almost done with reading Red Mist, and I have to say I'm so enjoying it.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy to tell you it's already landed at number one on the for hardback fiction and e-books on the New York Times list, and also for USA Today, so that's very happy news.
Well-deserved, I might say. Thanks a lot. All right, bye.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Red Mist, narrated by Kate Burton.
The van hesitates and surges by fits and starts around a sun-dappled bend where turkey buzzards forage on something dead. The huge, ugly birds with their ragged wings and naked heads lift off in slow, heavy flaps as I swerve around the stiff pelt of a raccoon, the sultry air carrying a sharp, putrid stench I know all too well. Animal or human, it doesn't matter. I can recognize death from a distance, and were I to get out and take a close look, I probably could determine the exact cause of that raccoon's demise and when it occurred and possibly reconstruct how it got hit, and maybe by what. Most people refer to me as a medical examiner, an ME, but some think I'm a coroner, and occasionally I'm confused with a police surgeon. To be precise, I'm a physician with a specialty in pathology and subspecialties in forensic pathology and 3D imaging radiology, or the use of CT scans to view a dead body internally before I touch it with a blade. I have a law degree and the special reservist rank of colonel with the Air Force, and therefore an affiliation with the Department of Defense, which last year appointed me to head the Cambridge Forensic Center it has funded in conjunction with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and Harvard. I'm an expert at determining the mechanism of what kills or why something doesn't, whether it is a disease, a poison, a medical misadventure, an act of God, a handgun, or an improvised explosive device, IED. My every action has to be legally well-informed. I'm expected to assist the United States government as needed and directed. I swear to oaths and testify under them. And what all this means is that I'm really not entitled to live the way most people do. It isn't an option for me to be anything other than objective and clinical. I'm not supposed to have personal opinions or emotional reactions to any case, no matter how gruesome or cruel. Even if violence has impacted me directly, such as the attempt on my life 4 months ago, I'm to be as unmoved as an iron post or a rock. I'm to remain hard in my resolve, calm and cool. You're not going to go PTSD on me, are you? The chief of the Armed Forces Medical Examiners, General John Briggs, said to me after I was almost murdered in my own garage this past February 10th. It happens, Kay. The world is full of whack jobs. Yes, John. It happens. It has happened before, and it will happen again, I replied, as if all were fine and I'd taken everything in stride, when I knew that wasn't what I was feeling inside. I intend to get as many details as I can about what went wrong in Jack Fielding's life, and I want Dawn Kincaid to pay the highest price. Prison with no chance of parole forever. I glance at my watch without taking my hands off the wheel of the van with this bad case of the shakes. Maybe I should turn around. The last flight out of here to Boston is in less than 2 hours. I could make it, but I know I won't be on it. For better or worse, I'm committed. As if I'd been taken over by an autopilot, maybe a reckless one, possibly a vengeful one. I know I'm angry. As my FBI forensic psychologist husband put it last night while I was cooking dinner in our historic Cambridge home that was built by a well-known transcendentalist, you're being tricked, Kay, possibly set up by others. But what concerns me most is you setting yourself up. What you perceive as your wish to be proactive and helpful is in fact your need to appease your guilt. I'm not the reason Jack is dead, I said.
You've always felt guilty about him.
You tend to feel guilty about a lot of things that have nothing to do with you. I see. When I think I can make a difference, I should never trust it. I used a pair of surgical scissors to cut the shells off boiled jumbo prawns. When I decide that taking a risk might produce useful information and help bring about justice, it's really my feeling guilty. You think it's your responsibility to fix things or prevent them? You always have. Going back to when you were a little girl taking care of your sick father.
That was Red Mist by Patricia Cornwell. If the new year has you hankering for a little Clancy in your life, there's Locked On by Tom Clancy with Mark Greaney. Although his dad had been reluctant to become a field operative, Jack Ryan Jr. wants nothing more. Privately training with a seasoned Special Forces drill instructor, he's honing his skills to transition his work within the campus from intelligence analysis to hunting down and eliminating terrorists. Even as Jack Ryan Sr. campaigns for re-election as President of the United States. But what neither father nor son knows is that the political and the personal have just become equally dangerous. An enemy of Jack Sr. launches a privately funded vendetta to discredit him by connecting the presidential candidate to a mysterious killing in the past. With the breakneck speed, tons of technology, and military action, Clancy delivers a novel in which the enemy within may be more devastating than the enemy without. Lou Diamond Phillips narrates.
The other five men who'd accompanied him from Makhachkala would be outside on guard, along with half of the local force. Each man awake, his rifle in his lap, a pot of hot tea close by. Israpil kept his own rifle within arm's reach, as it was his last line of defense. He carried the AK-74U, a cut-down barrel variant of the venerable but potent Kalashnikov. As he rolled onto his side to turn away from the draft, he reached out and put a gloved hand on the plastic pistol grip and pulled the weapon closer. He fidgeted for another moment like this, then rolled onto his back. With his boots laced on his feet, his pistol belt around his waist, and his chest harness full of rifle magazines strapped to his upper torso, it was damn hard to get comfortable. And it was not just the discomforts of the barn and his gear that kept him awake. No, it was the gnawing, constant worry of attack. Israpil knew well that he was a prime target of the Russians, because he knew what they were saying about him. That he was the future of the resistance. The future of his people. Not just the future of Islamic Dagestan, but the future of an Islamic caliphate in the Caucasus. Nabayev was a top priority target for Moscow, because he'd spent virtually his entire life at war with them. He'd been fighting since he was 11. He'd killed his first Russian in Nagorno-Karabakh in 1993 when he was only 15, and he'd killed many Russians since, in Grozny, and in Tbilisi, and in Tskhinvali, and in Makhachkala. Now, not yet 35 years old, he served as the military operational commander of the Dagestani Islamic organization Jamaat Shariat, the Islamic law community, and he commanded fighters from the Caspian Sea in the east to Chechnya and Georgia and Ossetia in the west, all fighting for the same goal, the expulsion of the invaders and the establishment of Sharia. And, inshallah, God willing, soon Israpil Nabayev would unite all the organizations of the Caucasus and see his dream fulfilled. As the Russians said, he was the future of the resistance. And his own people knew this too, which made his hard life easier. The 10 soldiers in his security force, along with 13 militants of the local Argvani cell, each and every one of these men would proudly lay down his life for Israpil. He flipped his body around again to shield it from the draft, moving the rifle with him as he tried to find some elusive comfort. He pulled the wool blanket over his shoulder and flicked the straw from his beard that came with it. Oh well, he thought to himself. He hoped none of his men would have to lay down his life before daybreak. Israpil Nabayev drifted to sleep in the darkness as a rooster crowed on the hillside just above the village. The crowing of the rooster interrupted the transmission of the Russian lying in the weeds a few meters away from the big bird. He waited for a second and a third call from the rooster. Then he put his lips back to the radio attached to his chest harness.
Alpha team to Overwatch. We have you in sight and will pass your location in 1 minute.
There was no verbal response. The sniper Overwatch team had been forced to close to within 10 meters of the edge of a cinder block shack in order to get a line of sight on the objective, another 100 meters on. They would not speak, not even whisper, so near to unfriendlies. The spotter just pressed his transmit button twice, broadcasting a pair of clicks as confirmation that he'd received Alpha's message in his earpiece. Above the spotter, higher on the steep hillside, 8 men heard the 2 clicks, and then they slowly approached in the black.
That was Locked On by Tom Clancy. One of our favorite cops, Harry Bosch, has been given 3 years before he must retire from the LAPD, and he wants cases more fiercely than ever. In one morning, he gets 2. In Michael Connelly's The Drop, DNA from a 1989 rape and murder matches a 29-year-old convicted rapist. Could he have been an 8-year-old killer? Or has something gone terribly wrong in the new regional crime lab? The latter possibility could compromise all of the lab's DNA cases currently in the courts. Then Bosch and his partner are called to a death scene fraught with internal politics. Councilman Irvin Irving's son jumped or was pushed from a window at the Chateau Marmont. Irving, Bosch's longtime nemesis, has demanded that Harry handle the investigation. Relentlessly pursuing both cases, Bosch makes two chilling discoveries: a killer operating unknown in the city for as many as 3 decades, and a political conspiracy that goes back into the dark history of the police department. Len Carew narrates.
Sometimes Bosch found it hard to sleep during the nights leading up to Christmas. He never took time off during the first week of the month and never came to work late if there was a chance that the yellow envelopes were in. Even his teenage daughter noticed his monthly cycle of anticipation and agitation and had likened it to a menstrual cycle. Bosch didn't see the humor in this and was embarrassed when she brought it up. Now his disappointment at the sight of so few envelopes in the lieutenant's hand was something palpable in his throat. He wanted a new case. He needed a new case. He needed to see the look on the killer's face when he knocked on the door and showed his badge, the embodiment of unexpected justice come calling after so many years. It was addictive, and Bosch was craving it now. The lieutenant handed the first envelope to Rick Jackson. He and his partner, Rich Bengston, were solid investigators who had been with the unit since its inception. Bosch had no complaint there. The next envelope was placed on an empty desk belonging to Teddy Baker. She and her partner, Greg Keough, were on their way back from a pickup in Tampa, Florida. An airline pilot who had been connected through fingerprints to the 1991 strangulation of a flight attendant in Brentwood. Bosch was about to suggest to the lieutenant that Baker and Keough might have their hands full with the Brentwood case, and that the envelope should be given to another team, namely his, when the lieutenant looked at him and used the last remaining envelope to beckon him to her office. "Can you guys step in for a minute? You too, Tim?" Tim Marcia was the squad whip, the detective three who handled mostly supervisory and fill-in duties in the squad. He mentored the young detectives and made sure the old ones, like Jackson and Bosch, didn't get lazy. Bosch was up out of his seat before the lieutenant had finished her question. He headed toward the lieutenant's office with Chu and Marcia trailing behind. "Close the door," Duval said. "Sit down." Duval had a corner office with windows that looked across Spring Street at the Los Angeles Times building. Paranoid that reporters were watching from the newsroom across the way, Duval kept her blinds permanently closed. It made the office dim and cave-like. Bosch and Chu took the 2 seats positioned in front of the lieutenant's desk. Marcia followed them in, moved to the side of Duval's desk, and leaned against an old evidence safe. "I want you two to handle this hit," she said, proffering the yellow envelope to Bosch. "There's something wrong there, and I want you to keep quiet about it until you find out what it is. Keep Tim in the loop, but keep it low-key." The envelope had already been opened. Chu leaned over to look as Harry opened the flap and pulled out the hit sheet. It listed the case number for which DNA evidence had been submitted, plus the name, age, last known address, and criminal history of the person whose genetic profile matched it. Bosch first noticed that the case number had an 89 prefix, meaning it was a case from 1989. There were no details about the crime, just the year. But Bosch knew that 1989 cases belonged to the team of Ross Schuler and Adriana Dolan.
That was The Drop by Michael Connelly. My guest today is Richard Preston, an internationally acclaimed author who took on the daunting task of completing Michael Crichton's novel Micro after the author's unexpected death in 2008. Michael Crichton, of course, is the author of well-loved blockbusters that included Jurassic Park and The Andromeda Strain. He was also the creator of ER. Crichton is the only writer to have had a number one book, movie, and TV show simultaneously. Micro, his last work, is the story of a group of grad students hired by a shadowy biotech company to undertake secret research in the Hawaiian rainforest. In an unfinished introduction to Micro, Crichton wrote, "Perhaps the single most important lesson to be learned by direct experience is that the natural world, with all its elements and interconnections, represents a complex system, and therefore we cannot understand it, and we cannot predict its behavior." Richard, our guest, became interested in Ebola virus and emerging infectious diseases in 1992. The result was a New Yorker article, which later became the bestseller The Hot Zone, and that inspired the movie Outbreak, starring Dustin Hoffman and Rene Russo. Next came the Cobra event, which describes a fictional bioterror event in New York City. A copy of the Cobra event ended up in President Clinton's hand, and it purportedly kept him awake for nights. Word was that Clinton even discussed the book at a White House National Security Council meeting. When the 2001 anthrax terror event happened, bioterrorism became real. Preston decided to write a nonfiction book about bioterrorism and the smallpox virus. The Demon in the Freezer was published in 2002. Welcome, Richard. Thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Hi, Elaine.
How did you get involved with finishing the manuscript of Micro?
Well, I got a call from Michael Crichton's agent. This was some months after he passed away. And I ended up going into New York and sitting down in a room with a fragment of the book. It ended up being about one-third of Micro. And I read through the pages. I saw a man working at white heat, and a man who was incredibly excited about his topic, writing fast and furiously, with ideas bubbling up. But I later learned that Michael at the time had been extremely ill. He had throat cancer, but he had not disclosed this to anybody at the time, except for his very closest family members. And he was going into the hospital, getting chemotherapy, and bringing his laptop with him, and then writing Micro while he was getting chemotherapy. Then he'd come home and write some more. I can almost not imagine that, how difficult that must have been for him. But it also shows his commitment. And I saw that in the manuscript, so I thought, this is really cool. I mean, I could see this extremely cool, high concept beginning to emerge. So I wrote up a little proposal and ended up meeting with Michael's widow, Sherry Crichton, who brought out some notebooks that she showed me, two little notebooks and some sheets of paper on hotel stationery of Michael's jottings and scribblings about the book. She had not disclosed this material to anybody, not even to her own lawyer. And I read through this, and I could see that that Michael had some extremely cool ideas. So at that point, I just really wanted to write the book.
Well, you have a PhD from Princeton in English, so how did science snare you away from literature?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've always been a science freak ever since I was a kid. I used to go to the public library in my town, and I would read more science books than literary books as a little kid. And then later on, when I got my degree at Princeton, I studied with John McPhee, the New Yorker author, the very distinguished writing professor, and I got terribly interested in nonfiction writing. It's a way of, you know, it's another way of bringing reality to readers without writing a novel. You can really do cool stuff with that, in science especially. So when I tackled writing Micro, I tackled it like a nonfiction assignment. In other words, I immersed myself in readings about insects and small creatures that inhabit the Hawaiian rainforest. I did pretty much what Michael Crichton himself did, which was he approached research with meticulous care.
Oh, and did you actually travel to Hawaii to the rainforest?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I should probably, I don't want to give away the book, but I should probably tell you a little bit about it. So the story involves seven graduate students from the East Coast who end up in Hawaii in the hands of a sociopathic venture capitalist who has this giant machine that can actually shrink people down to half an inch tall. And then he abandons them in the rainforest of Oahu, and they have to find their way back home. It's a story, it's like out of the Odyssey, I suppose. And so they encounter these absolutely horrifying challenges. If you think about insects, if you're half an inch tall, then some of these insects end up being armored monsters the size of Tyrannosaurus Rex, armed with chemical weapons, and they're pretty difficult to deal with. So when I went to Hawaii, I brought a little magnifying glass with me, and I went out into the rainforest, and I got down on my hands and knees and lay on my stomach and looked around to see what I could see, to get a sense of what the environment and the setting was really like.
That's fascinating. Back in July of this year, I spoke with Jeffrey Deaver about the challenges he faced writing Carte Blanche, which was the newest title in the official James Bond series. Talk about your challenges, you know, working on this book of Michael Crichton and you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, I had to sound like Michael Crichton, and I had to think like Michael Crichton. So I read a lot of his books. I went through them carefully, and I created a kind of cheat sheet for myself of his style points. You know, every author has style points, and Michael had a distinctive style. So I tried to systematically look at that and then duplicate it and tell the story in a Michael Crichton voice. So a lot of it is, because I'm a trained nonfiction writer, I've done a lot of interviews with people in which I have to recreate the voice of a character in one of my books. So I thought of this as another assignment like that, to try to essentially recreate the voice of Michael Crichton. I had quite a bit of help here. My help came from Michael's widow, Sherry Crichton, who went through the manuscripts with me very carefully, as well as a woman named Bonnie Jordan, who was Michael Crichton's longtime personal assistant. They went through the manuscript carefully, and they were able to identify places where I was sounding too much like Richard Preston and not enough like Michael Crichton. They had a very good ear for that. For example, at one point, Bonnie Jordan said to me, you've got the word meanwhile in here. You know, Michael never used the word meanwhile. And I'm like, oh, really? She said, yeah, when he wrote a slam-bang narrative scene, there are no meanwhiles in Michael Crichton. Everything happens one event after another. And I said, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, aren't you? So we went through the manuscript on a seek-and-destroy mission to take out every meanwhile. I had a lot of fun researching the science of the micro-world. And one of the things I found out is that the physics of the micro-world is very different if you're a half an inch tall. So, for example, the characters encounter ants. Now, think about ants if you're half an inch tall. An ant nest is 10,000 creatures the size of pit bulls that are armored and are equipped with giant shearing mandibles that can cut your head off. Mm. However, humans that size are as strong as ants, so to speak. In other words, if we're shrunk down, we also acquire enormous strength, almost superhuman powers. So the humans, when they're dealing with these threats, these monsters, themselves are not without their own resources. And in addition to that, these kids, these students, have to figure out their own chemical weapons, their own weapons, and how to deal with them.
Thanks so much for joining us today. And Micro is one great read.
Thanks, Aline. Good to be with you.
Alrighty. Bye.
Bye.
And now, here's a sampling of Micro by Michael Crichton and Richard Preston, performed by John Bedford Lloyd.
In the second floor biology lab, Peter Jansen, 23, slowly lowered the metal tongs into the glass cage. Then, with a quick jab, he pinned the cobra just behind its hood. The snake hissed angrily as Jansen reached in, gripped it firmly behind the head, raised it to the milking beaker. He swabbed the beaker membrane with alcohol, pushed the fangs through, and watched as yellowish venom slid down the glass. The yield was a disappointing few milliliters. Jansen really needed a half dozen cobras in order to collect enough venom to study, but there was no room for more animals in the lab. There was a reptile facility over in Alston, but the animals there tended to get sick. Peter wanted his snakes nearby, where he could supervise their condition. Venom was easily contaminated by bacteria. That was the reason for the alcohol swab and for the bed of ice the beaker sat on. Peter's research concerned bioactivity of certain polypeptides in cobra venom. His work was part of a vast research interest that included snakes, frogs, and spiders, all of which made neuroactive toxins. His experience with snakes had made him an envenomation specialist, occasionally called by hospitals to advise on exotic bites. This caused a certain amount of envy among other graduate students in the lab. As a group, they were highly competitive and quick to notice if anyone got attention from the outside world. Their solution was to complain that it was too dangerous to keep a cobra in the lab and that it really shouldn't be there. They referred to Peter's research as working with nasty herps. None of this bothered Peter. His disposition was cheerful and even-handed. He came from an academic family, so he didn't take this backbiting too seriously. His parents were no longer alive, killed in the crash of a light plane in the mountains of Northern California. His father had been a professor of geology at UC Davis, and his mother had taught on the medical faculty in San Francisco. His older brother was a physicist. Peter had returned the cobra to the cage just as Rick Hutter came over. Hutter was 24, an ethnobotanist. Lately, he had been researching analgesics found in the bark of rainforest trees. As usual, Rick was wearing faded jeans, a denim shirt, and heavy boots. He had a trimmed beard and a perpetual frown. "I notice you're not wearing gloves," he said. "No," Peter said. "I've gotten pretty confident." "When I did my field work, you had to wear gloves," he said. Rick Hutter never lost an opportunity to remind others in the lab that he had done actual field work. He made it sound as if he had spent years in the remote Amazon backwaters. In fact, he had spent 4 months doing research in a national park in Costa Rica. "One porter in our team didn't wear gloves and reached down to move a rock. Bam! Tercio Palo sunk its fangs into him. Fur de Lance, 2 meters long. They had to amputate his arm. He was lucky to survive at all." "Uh-huh," Peter said, hoping Rick would get going. He liked Rick, but the guy had a tendency to lecture everybody. The person in the lab who really disliked Rick Hutter was Karen King. Karen, a tall young woman with dark hair and angular shoulders, was studying spider venom and spider webs. She overheard Rick lecturing Peter on snake bite in the jungle and couldn't stand it. She had been working at a lab bench, and she snapped over her shoulder, "Rick, you stayed in a tourist lodge in Costa Rica, remember?"
"Bullshit. We camped in the rainforest."
"2 whole nights," Karen interrupted him, "until the mosquitoes drove you back to the lodge."
That was Micro by Michael Crichton and Richard Preston. And if you love a good legal thriller, and who doesn't, here's the latest Grisham fix, The Litigators. The partners at Finley & Figg often refer to themselves as a boutique law firm, chic, selective, and prosperous. Not so. What they are is a two-bit operation in search of their big break, an ambulance-chasing firm whose specialties are quickie divorces and DUIs, with the occasional jackpot of a car wreck thrown in. And then, David Zink, a young but already burned-out attorney, walks away from his fast-track career at a fancy downtown firm, goes on a serious bender, and finds himself literally at the Finley & Figg doorstep. With their new associate on board, F&F is ready to tackle a really big case, a case that could make the partners rich without requiring them to actually practice much law. An extremely popular drug for the dangerously overweight has recently come under fire after several patients taking it have suffered heart attacks. Smells like money. A little online research confirms that a huge Florida firm is putting together a class action suit against the drug company. All Finley and Fig has to do is find a handful of people who've had heart attacks while taking the drug, convince them to become clients, join the class action, and ride along to fame and fortune. It almost seems too good to be true. And it is. Dennis Poutsikaris narrates.
He was still married to his first wife, a terrifying woman he wanted to sue every day for his own divorce, but he couldn't afford it. After 32 years of lawyering, Oscar Finley couldn't afford much of anything. His junior partner, and Oscar was prone to say things like, "I'll get my junior partner to handle it," when trying to impress judges and other lawyers, and especially prospective clients, was Wally Figg, age 45. Wally fancied himself a hardball litigator, and his blustery ads promised all kinds of aggressive behavior. "We fight for your rights," and "insurance companies fear us," and "we mean business." Such ads could be seen on park benches, city transit buses, cabs, high school football programs, even telephone poles, though this violated several ordinances. The ads were not seen in two crucial markets, television and billboards. Wally and Oscar were still fighting over these. Oscar refused to spend the money. Both types were horribly expensive, and Wally was still scheming. His dream was to see his smiling face and slick head on television saying dreadful things about insurance companies while promising huge settlements to injured folks wise enough to call his toll-free number. But Oscar wouldn't even pay for a billboard. Wally had one picked out, 6 blocks from the office at the corner of Beach and 32nd, high above the swarming traffic, on top of a 4-story tenement house. There was the most perfect billboard in all of metropolitan Chicago, currently hawking cheap lingerie, with a comely ad, Wally had to admit. The billboard had his name and face written all over it, but Oscar still refused. Wally's law degree came from the prestigious University of Chicago School of Law. Oscar picked his up at a now-defunct place that once offered courses at night. Both took the bar exam 3 times. Wally had 4 divorces under his belt. Oscar could only dream. Wally wanted the big case, the big score with millions of dollars in fees. Oscar wanted only 2 things, divorce and retirement. How the 2 men came to be partners in a converted house on Preston Avenue was another story. How they survived without choking each other was a daily mystery. Their referee was Rochelle Gibson, a robust black woman with attitude and savvy earned on the streets from which she came. Ms. Gibson handled the front, the phone, the reception, the prospective clients arriving with hope, and the disgruntled ones leaving in anger. The occasional typing, though her bosses had learned if they needed something typed, it was far simpler to do it themselves. The firm dog, and most important, the constant bickering between Oscar and Wally. Years earlier, Ms. Gibson had been injured in a car wreck that was not her fault. She then compounded her troubles by hiring the law firm of Finley and Fig, though not by choice. 24 hours after the crash, bombed on Percocet and laden with splints and plaster casts, Ms. Gibson had awakened to the grinning, fleshy face of attorney Wallace Fig hovering over her hospital bed. He was wearing a set of aquamarine scrubs, had a stethoscope around his neck, and was doing a good job of impersonating a physician. Wally tricked her into signing a contract for legal representation, promised her the moon, sneaked out of the room as quietly as he'd sneaked in, then proceeded to butcher her case. She netted $40,000, which her husband drank and gambled away in a matter of weeks, which led to a divorce action filed by Oscar Finley. He also handled her bankruptcy.
That was The Litigators by John Grisham. Readers, it's hard to resist Stephanie Plum, Janet Ivanovich's entertaining and trouble-prone crime fighter. In her newest caper, Explosive 18, before Stephanie can even step foot off Flight 127, Hawaii to Newark, she's knee-deep in trouble. Her dream vacation has turned into a nightmare, and she's flying back to New Jersey solo. Worse still, her seatmate never returned to the plane after the L.A. layover. Now he's dead, stuffed in a garbage can, waiting for curbside pickup. After a ragtag collection of thugs and psychos, not to mention the FBI, are all looking for a photograph the dead man was supposed to be carrying. Only one other person has seen the missing photo, our Stephanie. Now she's the target, with no wish to end up croaked in a can. Over at the bail bonds agency, things are going from bad to worse. Vinny's temporary HQ goes up in smoke. The ever stylish, not Lula, falls in love with an unsavory character. Morelli, Trenton's hottest cop, isn't talking about Hawaii. Ranger, man of mystery, isn't talking about Hawaii. And all Stephanie is willing to say about her Hawaiian vacation is, it's complicated. Lorelei King narrates.
I live in a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment on the second floor of an aging, three-story brick-faced apartment building located on the edge of Trenton. On a good traffic day at 4 a.m, it's a 10-minute drive to my parents' house or the bonds office. All other times, it's a crapshoot. Grandma Mazur was at the front door when I pulled to the curb and parked. She's lived with my parents since Grandpa Mazur took the big escalator to the heavenly food court in the sky. Sometimes I think my father wouldn't mind seeing Grandma step onto that very same escalator, but I can't see it happening anytime soon. Her steel gray hair was cut short and tightly curled on her head. Her nails matched her bright red lipstick. Her lavender and white running suit hung slack on her bony shoulders. "What a good surprise," Grandma said, opening the door to me. "Welcome home. We're dying to hear all about the vacation with the hottie." My parents' home is a modest duplex, sharing a common wall with its mirror image. Mrs. Chiak lives in the other half. Her husband has passed on, and she spends her days baking coffee cake and watching television. The outside of her half is painted pale green, and the exterior of my parents' house is mustard yellow and brown. It's not an attractive combination, but it feels comfortable to me since it's been that way for as long as I can remember. Each half of the house has a postage stamp front yard, a small covered front porch, a back stoop leading to a long narrow backyard, and a detached single-car garage. I lug the laundry basket through the living room and dining room to the kitchen where my mother was chopping vegetables. "Soup?" I asked her. "Minestrone. Are you coming for dinner?" "Can't. Got plans." My mother glanced at the laundry basket. "I just put a load of sheets into the washer. If you leave that here, I'll do it later for you. How was Hawaii? We didn't expect you home until tomorrow." "Hawaii was good, but the plane ride was long. Fortunately, I sat next to a guy who got off when we stopped in L.A., so I had more room." "Yeah, but you were also next to Mr. Tall, Dark, and Mysterious," Grandma said. "Not exactly." This got both their attention. "How so?" Grandma asked. "It's complicated. He didn't fly back with me." Grandma stared at my left hand. "You got a tan, except on your ring finger. It looks like you were wearing a ring when you got a tan, but you're not wearing it no more." I looked at my hand. Bummer. When I took the ring off, I hadn't noticed a tan line. "Now I know why you went to Hawaii," Grandma said. "I bet you eloped. Of course, being that you don't got the ring on anymore would put a damper on the celebration." I blew out a sigh and poured myself a cup of coffee. I took a sip, and my phone rang. I dug around in my bag, unable to find my phone in the jumble of stuff I'd crammed in for the plane trip. I dumped it all out onto the little kitchen table and pawed through it. Granola bars, hairbrush, lip balm, hair scrunchies, notepad, wallet, socks, 2 magazines, a large yellow envelope, floss, mini flashlight, travel pack of tissues, 3 pens, and my phone. The caller was Connie Rizzoli, the bail bonds office manager. "I hope you're on your way to the office," she said, "because we have a situation here." "What sort of situation?" "A bad one." "How bad? Can it wait 20 minutes? 20 minutes sounds like a long time. I disconnected and stood. "Gotta go," I said to my mother and grandmother. "But you just got here," Grandma said. "We didn't get to hear about the eloping." "I didn't elope." I returned everything to my messenger bag, with the exception of the phone and the yellow envelope. I put the phone in an outside pocket, and I looked at the envelope. No writing on it. Sealed. I had no clue how it had gotten into my bag.
That was Explosive 18 by Janet Ivanovich. Riders, I hope our little thrill ride took your mind off the mundane. If action is not your genre, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for a world of other titles making early headlines in 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you back here next week on The Book Report.